This is Follow Spot, San Diego Theater Scene's bi-weekly podcast focused on the people who make theater in San Diego County, with news, views, and conversation to inform you of what's happening in San Diego's exciting theater community. And now here is your host, Dale Morris.
Welcome to San Diego Theater Scene Podcast, coming to you from the delightful gallery of Michael Thomas Towers' huge apartment. Michael, thanks for having us over to your house.
Yeah, I'm sorry I didn't clean up before you got here.
We've got a lot to talk about. We haven't been getting together very often because of differing schedules, and you did a wonderful podcast last week.
Oh, well, thank you.
Yes, thank you very much.
Great. It was just fabulous, and let's get going. I'm back from a camping vacation with Jamie. We had a wonderful time. And speaking about Jamie, she's been working hard on a play that both of you are working on right now. Which is a play called Knowing When, and it's written by Michael. And Michael, I really think it's good. I like it a lot. 10-minute play. It's going to be one weekend only, October 24th and 25th at 8 p.m., and that's over at the North Park
Vaudeville and Candy Shop, the 6th annual North Park Playwright Festival.
And these guys are amazing, you know. Every time I go to one of these, and I don't go often, but every time I go, they're full. They're packed. They got, what, 30 seats, 40 seats?
35, I think. And it's filled almost every night.
Please, take a chance on this place. It's called the North Park Vaudeville and Candy Shop. The play is Knowing When. It's written by Michael Thomas Tower. It's starring my girlfriend, Jamie Lloyd, and Kelly's boyfriend, Oryk Smith. And it is directed by Kelly Lepchinsky.
There you go. That's a bit of a family affair,
isn't
it?
It's kind of a family affair here. So, but you know, the thing I'm telling you is this is a really good play. It's a part of their festival. So how many plays will be that night?
Five or six.
Yeah, I think it may be as far as eight. Six to eight. Let's leave it there.
All of these plays are new. All of them are fun. They're done by local folks. It's our big deal.
Well, there are 28 plays total, I believe, 20 directors. I talked to Jeff yesterday, over 50 actors involved. It's a lot of people putting up the plays.
So you
I guess it's an average
it
of seven plays
a night,
per
Well, good
right.
for them, and I wish them a lot of success, and I can't wait to come see this one and the others.
Give the phone number there.
Oh, the phone number to buy tickets, thank you, is 619-220-8663. Folks, it's $14. Come on. Give him a shot. All right, let's move on. We've got Later Than Ever Productions coming in.
We do. We have Federico Moramarco, who is the artistic director of Later Than Ever, coming. Also, Kathy Jones, the managing director, will be here with him. Uh-huh. They'll be talking about, first of all, and most importantly, probably, their new season kickoff gala and a silent auction. It's their big fundraiser audience-building event. It's coming up on September 20th, and it's going to be on the roof of the 10th Avenue Playhouse, so it sounds like it could be a very interesting event. I can't wait to hear more about that from them.
Sounds like you can get high.
Yes, good.
That still matters to some of us.
And they're also doing a He Said, She Said play series. They're both adapting different authors. I think he's adapting Ray Carver. She's adapting Grace Paley. So that's also something that comes up for them, I think, January and March. So again,
He Said, She Said. Is that like, I don't know, that sounds interesting.
It does sound interesting. And to find out more, we'll just have to wait to hear from them, because that's really about all I know about it.
All right. Well, that's going to be our show for today. So stick with us. We'll be right back. And Michael, before we go to our first guest, I want to talk just for a minute about what happened to you and your other show, your mini shows. Michael is the resident playwright of Compass Theater, and as a part of our Q series of plays that encompass, I like that, the gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender community. He's written a play, a musical actually, called Backwater Blues, that will be premiering
October 26th.
They're in rehearsals right now. It's premiering at Compass Theater, and you got some news this morning. Can you tell us about it?
Well, yes, just a few minutes ago, the director phoned me and told me that we had lost our lead.
And that just sucks, because he probably just quit, right?
Oh, yeah, he quit to take a role in the National Touring Company of Jesus Christ Superstar. He begins his rehearsals in New York on the day we open here.
And what, he's only getting paid, $6 more than us? Or
something
what?
Like that, yeah. Joseph Almohaya. No, all the best to him. He's wonderful, and I'm not surprised that somebody else is picking him up that way. We would have been very fortunate to have him. However, we're very fortunate to already have a very competent replacement in Anthony Simone.
And your director, Lindsay?
Lindsay Gerhardt Duos. Yes. She's now using her married name, although she's not married yet.
She likes the name.
She's jumping the gun a little bit. She already has Anthony lined up. He auditioned for us at the same time everybody else did. We liked him very much. She just decided to go with Joseph, and we're really glad to be able to bring Anthony into it. As I remarked to her, and I had just said this yesterday to somebody else, it seems like whenever you have to replace somebody, that replacement ends up being the one you should have had in the first place.
Well,
for whatever reason, it just seems to work that way.
And it's wonderful, too, to have that many qualified people that audition. It's just wonderful when you couldn't use everybody that was usable, but they're there. They're somebody that you absolutely
would have used. We had others that were just really good that we wanted to use, but...
Well, I think it makes it a very interesting thing. Your new fellow, Anthony, is an African-American. They're going into a town in Texas that's a kind of...
Well, no, it's not defined as Texas. It isn't defined where it is. It's
okay.
Just a little backwater burg someplace.
A backwater burg. And your lead, Anthony, his character falls in love with a young man from that local area, right?
Sort of.
Okay. I guess you're not letting me give away the details.
Tight-lipped, he wants it to come to the show.
More or less, yeah. Well, somebody else falls in love with him, and it gets complicated.
It's a backwater triangle. Yeah. And now it's an interracial triangle. Interracial and homosexual triangle. Now, I'm musical.
Wow. There's a headline here somewhere. I like this. Folks, put it on your calendar. Backwater Blues by Michael Thomas Tower, a gay musical.
And David M. Newcomer.
And sometime we'll have to talk about that collaboration and how that worked. But come and see Backwater Blues at Compass Theater. We're going to be promoting a lot of other shows today besides Compass Theater, so stick with us.
Before we get away from Compass shows, let's just mention Hairdresser on Fire is on now.
Hairdresser on Fire, which is the first
play in our Q Plays series. Wonderful play. They're doing a wonderful performance of it. That's Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday evenings.
Thank you, folks. We'll be right back. We're happy to have with us today the honchos, the head guys, the big shots from Later Than Ever Productions. I'm going to be able to say that properly here very soon. Federico Maramarco and Kathy Jones, welcome. Thank you for being with us.
Well, thank you for having us.
We're also joined by Michael Thomas Tower and Kelly Lepchinski, so we got a house full here today. Fred, tell us just a little bit about the history of Later Than Ever Productions here in San Diego.
Well, I started Later Than Ever Productions in 2004 in connection with the 2004 election. I wanted to do my bit in terms of not getting Bush elected.
Didn't work, did it?
It didn't work, but I did produce a play called Mrs. Farnsworth, which was a very funny play by A.R. Gurney and has had no West Coast productions because nobody wants to touch it in the big theaters since it was so anti-Bush. And in any case, that was the start. And then I ran into Kathy, who was a colleague of mine at San Diego State. We ran into one another at a grocery store. And she told me about this wonderful play called Hannah and Martin. And I told her I just started this little theater company. And the rest is more or less history. Kathy sent me a copy of this play. I read it and loved it. And we got together and put on this play called Hannah and Martin. And that was also a West Coast San Diego premiere. And also it won an award for outstanding production of that year, 2006.
Kathy, how'd you find that play?
I knew about it because I've worked on the philosophy of Hannah Arendt for a number of years, and my former professor told me about the play. And it's a play that looks at the relationship, quite troubled and troubling, between Hannah Arendt and Martin Heidegger.
Yeah, Heidegger had a reputation of being a Nazi, wasn't he?
Yes, he was a Nazi. He was a member of the Nazi National Socialist Party, and Hannah Arendt was his student when she was about 18, and they began a love affair that lasted for about 5 years. They had a separation, and then they came back together again as friends and stayed friends for the remaining 30 years of their lives. And so the play explored that controversy, the how could somebody like Hannah Arendt, intelligent, insightful, strong anti-fascist, fall in love with and sustain a friendship with a man who was a known Nazi.
Well, you know, that's a show I wish I'd seen. You know, that's one of those shows you think, God, I wish I'd have gone and seen that show. Well, that's a conversation for another time.
Sure.
It really would be a wonderful conversation to have. But with the time that we've got, I'd love to talk about two things involving you guys. First thing, you've got a new season.
That's right.
It's called He Said, She Said.
That's right.
And you've got, and I want to talk about that. But you've also got a very important kickoff gala coming up September 20th. Federico, can you?
Yes, we're really excited about that because we've put together an event that's, I think, unique in San Diego. It's called An Urban Evening Under the Stars, and it will be on the roof of the 10th Avenue Playhouse in San Diego, which is the venue we're using this year for our shows.
Between E and Broadway.
Right.
Beautiful off-Broadway downtown San Diego.
Yes, way
come
off
and get high. Later than ever.
Come and get high with later. That's interesting. But it's, of course, a lovely view of the San Diego skyline from there, and we've gotten some wonderful donation. We're going to have a silent auction. We're going to have music. We're going to have dancers there. The Evoke Dance Company is dancing. We're going to have both a silent auction and a live auction of wonderful items that we've had donated from artists, from restaurants, from massage parlors, hotels,
yoga studios.
All kinds of places. So
the massage parlor is on the bad side of town or the good side of town?
High massage, Dale.
Well, you're making the
real
Dale
thing.
Really interesting. Yeah. Get high having a massage.
Well, you hear that
which
he
one
said,
will get
she
us
said,
a, more of an audience,
the
Dale?
The bad side of town. You know our listeners out there. Well, how if somebody wanted to come to that gala, how would they do it?
Well, we've put out an information box on our website, laterthanever.org. We're a nonprofit theater company.
Laterthanever.org.
And also, you can just come down a little before 6 p.m. At the 10th Avenue Playhouse between E and Broadway. And we're asking for a $25 contribution at the door. But of course, especially for people who are actors in the theater, we'll accept whatever donation they can make. You could
an
call.
An old pair of shoes.
An old
know.
Pair of shoes yes. would work as long as they are the right size and can be used in our upcoming productions.
Come up with your prop list.
Exactly.
Have them donate.
There you go. That's a great idea. But call 619-235-9353 for further information.
One more time.
619-235-9353.
Okay. That's the kickoff gala.
It's the kickoff gala helping to fund our season, He Said, She Said.
Okay, come out and support that, folks. They need your help. Kelly pointed out to me that the headline on your website is a very good one, Theater That Makes a Difference in People's Lives. That's one of those that, you know, I wish I'd have come up with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I hear and feel that all the time, things I wish I'd have come up with.
Well, but we could steal it.
All right, we'll copy it. Copy and paste. Seriously, I just like that. Theater that makes a difference in people's lives. We've already talked about a couple of your plays. Now, how does this wonderful title fit into the rather comical almost title of He Said, She Said?
Well, with He Said, She Said, we've taken the short stories of two of America's stellar premier short story writers, Raymond Carver mm-hmm. and Grace Paley. Both of whom are known for exploring in deep, dark, and often funny detail the complexities of our intimate lives in the context of decades of social change. And what we've done is we've moved from a kind of large-scape set of issues that we explored in Hannah and Martin through a personal relationships that opened out into big political, philosophical questions. In a sense, we've turned it in the opposite direction now, thinking that we are living in a time of great economic upheaval, social transformation, political change, and people are really thrown back on themselves. And we wanted to take the voices of two outstanding short story writers and adapt what they had to say about how life happens and what ways these issues of our times reverberate in our personal life.
Kathy, can you give us an example?
Yeah, well, I'll speak about Grace Paley because I'm adapting the short stories of Grace Paley for the stage. And by the way, it's the first time her stories will ever have been adapted for the stage. There was a video, I know, in the background of the history of her stories that appeared, but never for the stage. So we're taking eight stories of hers and looking at, as she did, the life cycle of a woman named Faith, who goes from her 20s through her 50s and experiences just about every change in your life of human relationships that you can experience. And through this period of time, which covers about the 50s to the mid-70s, of course, there's a lot going on. It's in the background of the stories, but Faith struggling with, you know, her relationship with her husband, her then ex-husband's, questions of where she stands in the world as a woman trying to raise two young boys on her own, her parents aging in a retirement home in Coney Island, the changes that are going on in Coney Island reflected in the changing demography of New York. She's a Jewish woman by the name of Faith, amazingly enough. And so even though there's a strong theme that will reverberate with people who, like me, come from the Big Apple, it explores things that go way beyond any particular cultural framework.
You know what? I couldn't help but get images. This is probably going to floor you, but images of Ethel Fugard as you were describing. Because if you read his plays, if you go to see his plays are all about apartheid and other, what else is there? I mean, they're all about apartheid, yet the word's never said.
Right. Mm.
It's never brought up, but you feel it all the way through. Mm-hmm. That was the image I got as you were explaining that. So this woman's life is there in all this hell is all around her, and it's got to affect some way.
Exactly. Yeah. And the changes that she goes through in some ways are mapped onto these unspoken changes in the social and political landscape, and they reflect a lot of the complexities of modern womanhood and masculinity and aging and parenting and all the pressures that we're feeling now.
How do you put this into play?
How do you put it into the play is exactly what I'm struggling with right now.
No, you got to figure this out by when? January? When does it start?
Well, to be honest, I'll tell you a little bit about the opening. I open with the character of Grace Paley herself and use her as a kind of presenter of the role of the writer in the 21st century. Grace Paley was an incredible activist, especially around peace issues and anti-war and social equity and social equality issues. And so she comes on stage and says, hey, what a time we're living in, huh? And then I take the characters that she created back in time and look at an older woman in her 50s, somewhat older, let's say, because I'm right there myself.
My age.
And her reflections about love and romance in her life and how she finally comes into her own in her later 50s. Yeah. This then sets the main character, Faith, into a series of reflections about her own life and the rest of the play is about Faith.
So you pull characters from her writing.
Exactly.
And the dialogue. And you put them on the stage in front with her dialogue.
Exactly.
And I suppose you have to extrapolate some dialogue in there.
Absolutely.
You know,
yeah.
So this is a... would you call this an adaptation?
Adaptation, definitely. Definitely. Of her, she was an incredible writer of dialogue. In fact, several people talked about her as if she were a playwright. Her dialogue is both funny and dramatic, and the action in the stories moves through largely through dialogue. But, you know, of course, to make it dramatic on stage, I've got to make the action much more palpable.
Yeah, well, I can't wait to see it.
Thank you.
Now, is that the first one in your series?
No, that's actually the second one. It's going to be in March of 2009.
March of 2009.
And well, in honor of Women's History Month.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, keep us in mind back to talk about that. And maybe at the same time we'll be able to talk about Martin Heidegger, who I've actually read some of his stuff before I even realized if you can read it.
Yeah.
If you can read Heidegger, yeah. You know, you have to go over each sentence three
Being
times.
Being in time wasn't like your bedside reading?
Being in time,
reading?
Yes. Oh, God. Being in time. And phenomenology.
There
Remember that
go.
Word?
I
phenomenology.
Do. Phenomena.
He's Lord. Lord. He's heavy
Le
duty. Yeah, anyway, that's for another time. Yeah. Fred, so it's your job then. Now, I have never read. I've never read her.
The Collected Stories won a National Book Award.
Yeah, I'm going to read. Is she still alive?
No, she just died last year, as a matter of fact.
Well, I'm sorry about that. Now, I have read some of Raymond Carver, and it's the kind of stuff it's hard to put it down once you start reading it.
Yes. Well, I've taught Raymond Carver for about 20 years at San Diego State, since the late 80s, actually. And so I'm very familiar with his stories. I've used them in a lot of my classes. I taught a seminar just in his work, and students loved him. And they are very responsive to him, because they recognize in Raymond Carver a kind of a chronicler of our time. That is, he... particularly in relation to relationships, men, male-female relationships. He's just very perceptive about it. And just as Kathy is looking at Grace Paley's work, and Grace Paley is writing from a woman's perspective in terms of looking at relationships, Carver looks at these relationships from a man's perspective, since he's a male, obviously. I'm going to do three of Carver's stories as kind of three interrelated one-acts, because each of them deals with two couples that come together and talk, male-female couples. And the key piece is called What We Talk About When We Talk About Love, which is Carver's... one of his most famous...
It's like Phenomenology. It's about as complicated.
Most famous stories. And to me, it really deals with a central question in our time. What does love mean today, in today's world, in a world of mostly serial relationships? You know, people at the end, by the end of their... If you look at their whole lives, have had usually many love relationships. It's no longer... Well, not everybody.
No
not everybody.
No comment.
Not everybody. I'm talking about... I'm sorry. But Carver, of course, deals with problem relationships, like divorces, difficulties between men and women.
Yeah, in other words, every relationship.
Yeah, mostly every relationship. Yeah. And... there's a lovely little monologue right in the middle of this passage, which I'd love to read a bit if I could, because I think
that.
It will get at the issue more than anything I can say.
And this
say
is
about
a monologue, one more time, in the name of the piece.
The name of the piece is From What We Talk About When We Talk About Love. These are two couples. Mel and Terry are a couple. Mel is a doctor, a heart surgeon, actually, which is also sort of symbolic.
Yeah.
He's exploring the heart.
Yeah.
And Mel and Terry are a little bit older couple. And then there is Nick and Laura. They're a little bit younger. They're probably in their 30s. And Mel is... and Terry in their 40s.
Will you be playing this role in this show?
No, I not quite. A little bit older for her. but I do love to read this monologue, because
Please.
It speaks to me. It speaks to me. And it's by Mel, the doctor, who sort of holds forth here. You know how we defer to doctors all
sure.
the time. What do any of us know about love? Huh? Seems to me we're just beginners at love. We say we love each other, and we do. I don't doubt it. I love Terry. Terry loves me, and you guys love each other, too. You know the kind of love I'm talking about now, huh? Physical love, that impulse that drives you to someone special, well as love the other person's being, his or her essence, as it were. Carnal love. Well, call it sentimental love. The day-to-day caring about the other person. But sometimes... I have a hard time accounting for the fact that I must have loved my first wife, too. But I did. I know I did. So I suppose I'm like Terry in that regard, Terry and Ed. There was a time when I thought I loved my first wife more than life itself. But now I hate her guts. I do. How do you explain that? What happened to that love? What happened to it is what I'd like to know. I wish someone could tell me. Then there's Ed. Okay, we're back to Ed. He loves Terry so much, he tries to kill her. And he winds up killing himself. And you guys have been together for 18 months. You love each other. Shows all over. You glow with it. But you both loved other people before you met each other. You've both been married before that, too, even. Terry and I have been together 5 years, been married for four. And the terrible thing, but the good thing, too, the saving grace, you might say, is that if something happened to one of us tomorrow, the other person would grieve for a while, you know, but then the surviving party would go out and love again, have someone else soon enough. All of this love we're talking about, it would be just a memory. Am I wrong, huh? Am I way off base? Because I want you to set me straight if you think I'm wrong. I want to know. I mean, I don't know anything, and I'm the first one to admit it.
And that's from the play, What We Talk About When We Talk About Love. And is that a direct quote from the play, from Raymond Carver?
That's right. See, this play was particularly, I would say, easy to adapt because the play is the story is mostly all dialogue.
Yeah.
And it was just a matter of putting a little frame on it, you know, giving it a little context. But basically, it's all Carver's dialogue.
Every one of us have thought that, you know, and wondered about it and are amazed at how those transitions, that roller coaster ride develops. You're in full bloom, full flower, it starts wilting and it's gone.
What happened to it? Where
and
did
what
it go?
Happened to
and,
it?
You know, if I can just take it into another direction from that. I mean, it's very, very intimate, interpersonal stuff that he's talking about. But when you think about what's going on in the world today, things like, bam, one day I love my neighbor, the next day I hate that person, I'm slitting their throat.
Yeah.
How does that happen? Yeah. What are human emotions, and where do they come from? How do they thrive in one form and then transform into the polar opposite? And don't we need to be thinking about this a lot these days?
I'm reminded of something I heard a number of years ago, which has been always food for thought to me because it comes to mind every once in a while when we talk about love. That is that love as we know it today, certainly, is an invention of humankind. That in most of the history of humankind, there wasn't time for love. Yeah. That was a luxury. It was all about survival and mainly that, survival, breeding, everything that was connected with that. There wasn't time for love. It's really a luxury that we managed to invent as we progressed.
Mm-hmm. That is really an amazing thought. Mm-hmm. I read a book once called The Bicameral Mind. I wish I could remember the man's name who wrote it. But he said that the concept of I didn't even come along until maybe 3,000 years ago. Mm-hmm. And so the concept of love had to come in there somewhere, you know.
When would it come after I?
Yeah.
Pretty much the order: I, then love, then you.
I think that's part of the problem. Okay, we got to write a book. You know what? This is extraordinarily interesting, and we wish you all the best of luck with this. Now, we've just talked about two pieces.
That's right.
And there's going to be a total of how many pieces?
Well, the Carver play is three one-act plays,
yes,
interrelated, but the overall title is going to be what we talk about when we talk about love.
Right, and the title of the March show that
the
Kathy
March show,
Jones...
Well, we're still working on that. I think it's going to be either Acts of Faith, on that sort of double, triple entendre, or Faith in Our Times.
A-C-T-S or A-X-E?
A-C-T-S. No, Act. As in 1, 2, 3 acts. And it's a full-length play, yes, of three acts, and I've drawn on about 8 or 9 of Paley's stories to create this adaptation.
As a writer, I would be interested in knowing what was involved in getting the rights to do this.
Yeah, I actually worked with a woman I know who worked at Harcourt before Harcourt imploded, and she's helped us get the rights. We wrote to the Paley estate.
Was it Kathy
Canavy?
Yeah, she's a friend of mine.
Yeah. Oh, great, yeah. And she helped me get in contact with the Paley estate, who gave us the rights for the use of the stories for this one-time adaptation. And we had to announce, as you do, the number of performances that you're going to do. And they gave us a really reasonable arrangement as far as the finances are concerned. And Fred negotiated.
Yeah, I've been having ongoing contact with Tess Gallagher, who is Carver's widow, and she controls the Carver estate. and she works through an agent, and I just wrote to her.
I had always wondered, I had always assumed that it would have to be some very well-known writer to ever get the rights to write a play of a well-known novelist.
No.
And so that's encouraging to know that.
You mean you think I'm not a well-known writer? But it's a question of getting in touch with the literary estate, and sometimes they may and sometimes they may not give you permission.
We're speaking with Federico Maramarco, I'm sorry, Federico, and Kathy Jones, the honchos at Later Than Ever Productions, and the actual, your executive artistic director?
Artistic director.
And I'm managing director.
You're managing director.
And so in my role as managing director, please, everybody, come out on the 20th of September to the 10th Avenue Playhouse between E and Broadway, downtown San Diego.
And the phone number is 619-235-9353 to get more information about that September 20th kickoff gala. And you can get more information as well about this gala and all of their upcoming work at Later Than Ever Productions. It's not Later Than Never, which I made the mistake of. It's Later Than Ever Productions. Kathy Jones, Federico, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having us.
Welcome back to San Diego Theater Scene Podcast. You know, that I think that was one of the most interesting conversations we've had in a long time.
Monologue was great.
It was a great monologue by
Federico
Maramarco. That was a great monologue. And listening to Kathy Jones talk about Miss Paley with so much passion, even talking about their show that they did, what was it, Hannah and Martin. I want to talk about that with her sometime. Mm-hmm. Boy, that was just amazing. Anyway, they were great guests, and we hope that people get out there and support Later Than Ever Productions on their September 20th kickoff gala and for their shows that, did he say they started in January?
They've got the two of them, the He Said and She Said. I believe his must be the one that starts in January because she said hers was in March.
Yeah, okay. Well, folks, go back and listen once more to the last segment so that you get all those dates right.
Or just check out their website, laterthanever.org.
Thank you very much. And their phone number, again, is 619-235-9353. We just want to wrap things up here today. Please go to SanDiegoTheaterScene.com, that's SDTheater.com, to get caught up on all the shows that are worth seeing here in the San Diego area.
There have been tons of them here lately that have just opened and started or are auditioning for. There's been a lot going on here in the last couple weeks.
And it ain't going to change soon. I'm going Wednesday night, I hope, if I can find a way of getting out of rehearsal for Britannica's. They've got dresses, invited dresses for Dying City at Signet Theater.
Right.
I'm especially looking forward to seeing this because I was just in a play with Sean Cox, and he and Christy Yale, if I'm saying her last name right, are in that play together and at Signet, directed by Fran Gurk. And so I hope to see that Wednesday night.
Now, that one actually officially opens on the 27th,
Boy, I'm sorry. I don't know. Thank you for saying that.
I think so.
It's a quirky play, Sean Cox tells me, so I am looking forward to seeing
that. And those two have worked together. They just did 3 Days of Rain, which was a really great production for us, for Compass.
And for Compass Theater, and they were fabulous in it. And I think this is like Sean Cox's 10th, 11th, or 12th show with Sean Murray, going back 10 years, so they've worked together a lot. And of course, I just worked with Sean in the with both Seans in The Receptionist, which was just
And I so wanted to see that. I didn't get a chance to see that, but Josh Hyatt speaks very highly of it. And the set, I've heard so many people mention that set.
They could have taken that set out of there and just put it in any business anywhere, and it would have been their reception area.
Wow.
I mean, it was that good. Nick Fauch built it, and I'm drawing a blank. Sean Feeney, I believe, is the designer's name. All did a great job. Anyway, so get out there and see Dying City at Signet Theater. Now, just recently, I think you've seen a couple of shows.
I have. I have been out there. I saw the Dining Room at Scripps Ranch Theater. I'm producing their next show, The Last Night of Ballyhoo, so they were very kind to let me in to see the opening of the Dining Room and see how their openings work from the other side. I've done a couple shows there as an actor, but I've never been out in the lobby area for the opening night. I'm usually in the dressing room.
The Dining Room is one of probably A.R. Gurney's biggest hits.
It was one of my first shows, too. It was one of the things that it was very interesting to watch it. Between Allison McDonald and Sherry Allen,
I saw someone else interpret the roles that I had played many, many years ago, more years than I care to think about now, actually. And it was a lot of fun. There was a great scene. They did a wonderful choreographed setting of the dining room table. Uh-huh. And the dining room table, it's symbolic throughout just years how important the dining room
was. It's where
was.
The families gathered.
Yeah. And it was so important and so central to the family. And over years, that has sort of faded out of being true, but it was very interesting to watch that. But the setting of the table was a choreographed scene that the director, Eric Bishop, said at opening night that this was actually something that the cast worked together to come up with. And it was very ritualistic, which is so right for a dining room to be ritualistic. Just setting everything exactly right, setting the forks on the correct side, the knives on the correct side, the finger bowls, whatever it was very, very, very elaborate. Now, it did feel like the ending of the play, and there was still another scene after that.
Mm-hmm.
But that choreographed setting of the table.
That's what they get for having such a great scene.
I know. It really felt like, because the show opens with the dining room table, which they have a very lovely table, which I believe they have on loan from Jerome. So that's lovely that they were able to get that marketing tie-in. But it starts off with that under a cloth, as if the house is going to be sold. And so actually filling it back up with all of that wonderful tradition just felt so much like the end of the play. It wasn't, and there's a very nice scene at the end of it that brings all the actors back on. But that scene alone was worth the price of admission.
Okay, well, get out to Scripps Ranch. Do you recall when it closes? It just opened, I suppose.
I think it closes the weekend of, and perhaps just before October 4th.
Okay, get out to see Scripps Ranch, newest production of The Dining Room. How about Fat Pig, unusual title by Neil DeBute?
I did. I got out to see that as well. I talked to last week on the podcast Carla Nell and Kim Pappas, and they had a Pay What You Can night on September 11th, so I went out to that production, and it was a really interesting show. It's really hard, but accurate at the same time. Carla, very brave for taking on that role, because it is a look at how people treat larger women, particularly how they treat larger women in a relationship, and the not-so-large man who falls in love with her, and he really does. I really enjoyed, I forget which one was which. I think this was Brendan Cavalier. Ryan Ross was also in the show, and I apologize if I'm naming the wrong male actor. But I think he did a wonderful job creating that relationship with Carla. And you really believe Tom and Helen were in love, but he just couldn't deal with the way people treated him for his fat pig of a girlfriend. He just couldn't handle what people were throwing at them.
You know, is there a phenomenon that I've talked to people about this before, where you see a very large woman and a thin man together. Is that a phenomenon, or am I making it up?
I do see that. I do see that. It's not uncommon. Yeah. And, you know, as a woman myself, who is, I've got about a 50-pound roller coaster of my own. You know, you meet me at any time. Seriously.
Well, you looked really good in, what was that show I saw you in? The O'Connor
Girls. O'Connor Girls. Yeah, yeah. Still. In
a
fact, both of the
lead.
Times I've come to San Diego, I've gained 20 pounds. 2005 and then 2007.
All right, then just tell me.
I got to leave this town.
You can't leave town, right. Got to stay here.
When I look at you, though, I don't consider you heavy. Do you consider yourself heavy?
I do consider myself heavy, and I do feel like, not to the extent that Fat Pig, I don't feel
did
like
did it impact
I,
you?
It did. It did. I mean, it was very much you feel, and even in my own relationships, when you're on that roller coaster, you feel a definite difference between when you're at the lower end of the scale and how your boyfriend feels about you or treats you or takes you out in public, and when you go on the other end of the spectrum and how far out from the public eye that relationship becomes.
And you called the actress who played the title role brave, Carla Nell.
I did. I do, because there's a love scene in it, and she had to come out in a negligee. And a lot of heavier women who are concerned about that, and God bless Carla, she's not. She's very much like this character, which is one of the heartbreaking things about this character, that she's not overly concerned. She's happy with herself. She knows who she is. She knows she's a good person. She knows she's smart. She knows she's funny. And she is. And this is why Tom falls in love with her. But, you know, I know that the director, I know Kim doesn't like to give away the ending, so I'm going to try to refrain from doing that. But there is so much pressure on the boyfriend in trying to deal with that relationship that eventually she does have to become self-conscious about it, because she fears losing Tom.
Yeah.
And I think that's a very valid point. And yet, these two horrible office mates, you don't want to like them. They're the ones that are making it so hard for him to love the fat woman. And yet, you know, that's true. That is the way people talk. You know, I've heard it from people talking about other people who are larger than me, and I've heard the snickers at me.
Well, you got to give a lot of credit to the playwright, number one, for coming up with this concept and putting it on paper. And, you know, to have a local community theater mm-hmm. on stage productions to agree to put this play on
right.
is a risk. I mean, that's risky for any theater.
Well, on stage doesn't do them. They don't program the way most community theaters program.
They really don't.
They do some really
well, I think, and you do see this a lot, but they have as their artistic director an actress. And I think that Terry Brown reads scripts from an actor's perspective. I really do believe she picks something that if there were a role in it for her, she'd do. And I think that that makes it a more interesting, a more compelling season. You know, these are things that speak to her in some way. Now, I don't think she's been in one of their shows for a while. I'm not suggesting she picks shows that she can be in. I don't think she has been in any of them
but
for a while.
But she puts herself, she reads herself
but she reads
into
them.
The script.
Yes.
As she's reading the script.
She reads them with
I
the actor's
the same
eye.
Bloody thing, mm-hmm. when, you know. We give huzzas to onstage playhouse
absolutely.
For having the courage to do this play, and we encourage people to reward onstage playhouse for their risk by going down there and filling that place up. While it, do you have any idea when it closes?
Ooh, that one I don't know. I think it opened around the 5th, September 5th. So they usually run, I think, about 5 weeks. So you're probably still looking at that early October closing.
There's two places you can find out. They've been a sponsor of San Diego Theater Scene Newsletter. So if you look at www.sdtheater.com, you can see their big promo graphic on our website. And it will tell you exactly when they close and the phone number to call to get tickets. And, of course, you can always go to onstageplayhouse.org, I believe it is, mm-hmm. and see it there. Michael, what's going on with you? I know you got two of your plays. We talked about it in the intro. Anything else cooking?
Not so far as my plays are concerned. I'm going to be seeing Light in the Piazza next week at Lamb's Players, so I may have something to say about that afterwards.
Good.
It better be good, folks. I saw
that
the one in
on
L.A.,
the
and it was awfully good, so mm-hmm. I want to see something equal to that.
Okay, well, we look forward to hearing your thoughts on that. I'll talk to you about Dying City when we come back in 2 weeks.
And, you know, we've got, ironically, speaking of Fat Pig, you've also got The Good Body. Eve Ensler's The Good Body playing at the Rep.
Yeah.
So that's playing, I think that's already open. That's going
Linda
on now.
Libby just got some great reviews, and Carol
did she?
Foreman. Yeah, Carol
and
Foreman.
Of course we were going to speak to Carol Foreman here, and my apologies to her. We had a scheduling conflict, and that just didn't happen. But absolutely, go see the women at the Rep. I mean, we're hearing
one of
good
our
things
dear
about that.
Friends is in the women at the Rep.
Absolutely, Deanna Driscoll is in that show.
No, she's in The Good Body.
The Good Body. I'm sorry, one of our good friends is
Amy.
In. Which one were we talking about
Amy.
Then?
Amy.
Amy is in The Women, yes, The Women. I think I just jumped show to show is what happened there. I was talking about The Good Body.
Amy
but yes,
who? Give her
The Women, name. Amy Nelson, who also Deanna Driscoll, both women I was in Anton and Show Business with, so I think I may have made a jump there. Yeah. But yes, Amy Nelson is in The Women at the Globe,
oh,
and they're also
so
opening back. Yeah, yeah. Yes. I've done a lot of in fact, I spent months on end with Amy. I did the O'Connor Girls with her, and then Anton and Show Business, and then we did a stage reading in Carlsbad. Yeah. So
congratulations.
I don't know if I'm proud of her or mad at her. She went on to the Globe and
really left us all behind.
That's right.
Well, we knew that she had great things ahead of her, mm-hmm. and so I hope that she continues her climb. Well, I think that does it for us this week. We'll be back in 2 weeks. In the meantime, check out www.sdtheater.com and give us a call anytime you'd like at 619-688-9210 if you have ideas for shows or if you would just like to chat with us. Thank you. We'll see you next week. For Michael Thomas Tower and Kelly Lipchinski, this is Dale Morris, San Diego Theater Scene Podcast.
This has been Follow Spot, a podcast service of San Diego Theater Scene Incorporated, a nonprofit organization for the arts in San Diego, California. We invite you to visit our website, sdtheaterscene.com, for current comprehensive news and information about performance activities in San Diego County. Your host for this program has been Dale Morris, assisted by Kelly Lapchinsky, who is also program coordinator, and Michael Thomas Tower, who is also engineer and announcer. Thank you for listening, and we look forward to your being with us again soon.